The Finance and Revenue is open.
I tried to be cooperative, you saw.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to reverse order here today, and we're going to start with Senate Bill 1528. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1528. Kyle is here to give us a brief rundown of the Dash 13 amendment and the new revenue impact.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1528, we do have, yes, the Dash A13 amendment, which consists of some components of 1528, as was passed out to the floor earlier. So the two components that are in the bill from the one that's passed out earlier is the disconnect from the federal deduction for pass-through entities. So that was the newly created deduction as part of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act in December. And then the Oregon Opportunity Grant Auction Tax Credit. So again, that's the up to $14 million that will be auctioned each year, with the funds going to the Opportunity Grant Fund. So those are the two provisions that are remaining in the bill. You can see in the revenue impact statement, I've broken those two out. So the addition, give it a second here for get it loaded up, but the addition, or the disconnect, which is will show up as an addition here in Oregon to taxable income, is about $260 million for the 17-19 biennium, and then that raises up to $400 million and $455. And that's reflective of the additional tax years coming into play in the outer bienniums. So that's where we expect to stay, is in the $400 million range in the outer two. And then the opportunity grant credit, we pegged at $14 million for each tax year. So again, you see it initially at $14 million and then $28 million per biennium going forward. And that's assuming that we expect all the credits to be sold on the. Now again, this is the general fund, so you see the negative 14 or the negative 28 million. That's for the tax credit. Mm-hmm. On the fiscal impact statement, there's then a positive. They're putting it at a little over $13 million that then ends up in the opportunity grant fund. And in some ways, it's a debit from the general fund, but then you have a credit, or well, I should say a negative from the general fund, and then a positive in the Oregon Opportunity Grant Fund. So it works in some ways like an appropriation, similar to that. But I just wanted to call your attention that the positive, or the moving of the funds, is in the fiscal impact statement, mm-hmm. where the revenue is just showing that negative amount.
Okay. We have Chris Alanak here to take questions. Chris, did you want to walk through the amendment at all, or to refresh our memory of what we're doing here? This isn't the state tax break. We're talking about whether to disconnect or connect to the federal tax break.
Correct, Mr. Chair. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. So what the amendment does, you have the tax credit, but then there is the disconnect from the federal policy related to pass-through income. And there's been some confusion and with the Oregon policy. We have an Oregon policy that offers a preferential rate for certain pass-through entities that has been in effect. It was passed in 2013 special session and has been in effect since 2015. So taxpayers have claimed that in 15 and 16 and 17. The provision that this disconnects from is tied to the federal law changes that were passed at the end of December, and that is a distinct federal deduction from federal taxable income. So one federal policy that, due to our rolling reconnect, we are currently tied to. And so to disconnect from that, that's what this provision does. You have to actively disconnect from it. And taxpayers haven't claimed that yet. They would be claiming that in 2018 for the first time. So there are, you know, CPAs and tax lawyers are looking at this, and in anticipation, right now they're focusing on filing their 2017 returns. This federal piece will be first claimed in tax year 2018 when they file those returns in 2019. And so in some respects, it shows up as a revenue gain here, but it's in a different perspective. It's the prevention of a revenue loss to the general fund. That revenue loss was included in the forecast that you saw on Friday. So this basically undoes that revenue loss.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Haas. So when you started out, so I was not here in 2013, but of course this topic has come up many times, not just in this committee, but in other committees. And so I think you used the term preferential rate that was passed in 2013. Mm-hmm. So can you just so that it's all on the record and I understand exactly what happened in 2013 and how we came to having this pass-through, which it sounds like we didn't have before, and now we have these unusual circumstances, as I understand it, of President Trump with this new bill that came out of Congress. Now we have this unusual circumstance. If you could just talk about that, and then I want to ask about if any other state is in this, if any of the other 50 states are in these circumstances. That we're
sure. Chair Haas, Senator Taylor. Prior to 2013, we did not have any such preferential rate. And Oregon generally takes all income, sorry, for context also, takes income, whether it's wages or capital gains or dividends, all income goes into the same pot and would be taxed under our 5, 7, 9, and 9.9% rates. That's how it's been for a number of years. So that's the context. That's the background, if you will. In the 2013 special session, there was a bill passed that had a number of provisions, and one of them was this preferential rate for pass-through entities. Now, one of the things that adds some confusion here is the definition of pass-through entities.
Yes, thank you, please. Yes.
For the Oregon law. And so where the legislature landed in 2013, pass-through entities were S-corporations and partnerships and LLCs who file as partnerships and S-corps. They were not sole proprietors. So for the Oregon thing, I'm back in 2013 now. So it did not include sole proprietors. So it was basically limited to partnerships and S-corps and LLCs who filed as that. And for business owners who were actively involved in their business, they would get a preferential rate. So for these businesses, speaking very broadly, a business can have two kinds of income, active income and passive income. Mm-hmm. So if two people are involved in a business, they each invested $100,000 in the business, and one of them is on site every day dealing with day-to-day operations, they're intimately involved in everything. That's active income, or it's non-passive income. Whereas if the other person just invested their $100,000 and had nothing to do with day-to-day operations, business decisions, their return on that, their income from that would be passive income. The Oregon policy was focused on the business owners who were actively involved in their businesses. And there was an employment requirement, and the idea was access to capital for these businesses that they could then reinvest in the business and increase employment, and you get that kind of economic development approach to it. Mm-hmm. And the preferential rate, it was a sliding scale, but up to $5 million of this active income could get a lower tax rate. And it was a tiered bracket, and the bracket started at 7%. I think it went 7, 7.2, 7.6, 8, 9, and then 9.9. So as you got closer to the $5 million, that preferential rate got closer and closer to our baseline tax rate. So the tax break got smaller and smaller on those marginal dollars. The biggest break was for the first 250,000 of that income, where that income would be taxed at 7% instead of our 9%. And so it's very different from a deduction. And taxpayers, when they calculate this, they have to take their income and they put it into two pots. And this active income can get these lower rates. But to benefit from those rates, the taxpayers would have to give up their Schedule A income, or at least their Schedule A deductions couldn't be used against that income. So if you have a joint filer where one spouse has wage income, the Schedule A deductions could be used against that income. And if the other spouse has this active income, then that income would be subject to the lower rates. And so it gets kind of complicated, and it is a tax expenditure, but that's in the nature of the preferential rates. If you have this kind of income, it can be taxed at a lower rate.
So are any of the other 50 states in this circumstances, or do you not, or maybe you don't know, but?
It's always difficult to say definitively about what all other states are doing, but I'm not aware of any other states that have that particular policy.
So I'm just trying to, so we have on the record so everyone understands the, will you just define what a sole proprietor is, please? Just so that everyone is clear who's watching.
A sole proprietor is an individual who is structured and they file a Schedule C on their personal income tax return. Mm-hmm. They are in business for themselves. It's not a partnership and it's not an S corporation. They haven't filed those kinds of things. They haven't incorporated as an S corporation. They haven't filed the paperwork to be a partnership with somebody else. They're running the business mm-hmm. by themselves. And there's no legal distinction between their business and them as a taxpayer, whereas these other entities, there's a distinction mm-hmm. between the business and the taxpayer.
Mm-hmm. So to follow up, Senator House, the reason why I'm bringing this up is that because I too think there's been a lot of confusion, and it seems that some people tune in and out of, I mean, I understand, we don't always talk about the most exciting things in here. So some people tune in and out of what's going on in the Revenue Committee, I would say. And so this is just an opportunity, and it just wanted to make certain that we have everything on the record, because I'm a little bit confused about some people having reservations at this point about this bill. I'm supporting the bill and happy to vote yesterday for it. The this, if it was already quite a generous benefit to have what was passed in 2013. To then have, and obviously we did not cause this to occur, but what was passed in Congress, to then have that go through, now it seems as if this is extremely over-the-top generous. So I'm trying to understand who this really benefits and who this really, you know, there's a negative impact to. So one of the things that that I've been talking with some of our colleagues about is that this isn't about people, these are about people who own a business. This is not as if it's your own, the active people working within there. So if you can just clarify about who is going to be benefiting from this and who is not necessarily, you don't not have to, obviously, just in general, a definition of who will benefit and not benefit from this.
On the federal piece?
Yes.
Yeah,
in the combination with what we already have with the 2013 pass-through.
So the federal, there are some similarities and some differences. And okay. The federal piece is a deduction. It's a 20% deduction taken on the individual's tax return. And the deduction is up to 20% of their qualified mm-hmm. business income. And the one way to think about that, I guess, in all the research we've been doing and trying to understand the details of it, and there's CPA, we're talking with CPAs, and they're still working through this. It's basically the net income from the business that gets claimed on the taxpayer's return. So the individual is filling out their 1040, and they will get a 20% deduction of this business income. Now, that business income, the federal policy doesn't make the distinction necessarily between the active and passive income. So some passive income, like certain dividends and net interest, are excluded from that deduction. But some passive income is included in the federal deduction. It's not limited just to the active income. And then the federal policy is also extended to sole proprietors. But it is a deduction taken on the individual's tax return. And as long as their taxable income is under certain thresholds, they get this 20% deduction. And these thresholds are, it's about $150,000 for single filers and $300,000 for joint filers. Those are rounded numbers. And the best reading of the law right now, and as we're talking to CPAs and tax lawyers about this, is that if you're under that, you get the 20% deduction. If you get above that, then it gets to be more complicated. And there are other restrictions that come into play depending on the field of the certain service sectors will be limited and eventually gets phased out. But all of that happens on the individual's tax return, and it's a deduction. It lowers federal taxable income, and because we tie with federal taxable income, that's our starting point. That's why it automatically affects Oregon, and that's why it was embedded in the forecast released on Friday.
Yeah, I'll hold off with the rest of my questions, Chair Hass.
No, thank you, Senator Burchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I'm going to help you out or make it worse, Chris, but in my simple mind, we're really disconnecting from that 20% discount, and we're going to go back to the AGI. That's the number we'll be using on the federal tax return for taxable income at the state level.
Senator Bartschiger, this has been another point where there's been a lot of confusion, and the tax return starts with AGI. And as far as I know, for decades, DOR has structured the form that way, and it's for the convenience of the taxpayer, because that's a more intuitive approach to filing taxes. And the way I've talked about that is, if the form started with federal taxable income, taxpayers would be adding information to the form that wasn't relevant for their taxes. So we start with AGI. So if I don't know that DOR has decided if they're going to change the forms, I wouldn't expect that they would. My expectation is that if the state were to stay tied to this federal deduction, the deduction would need to be added to the form, and probably under a subtraction section, which is, subtraction is another word for deduction. If the state chooses to disconnect from the provision, then there would be no change to the form. If that gets at your question.
Yeah, that's how I understand it.
Okay.
Yeah, so like the AGI on the a federal tax form would be on page one, I think, and this new 20% discount would be on page two. We're actually gonna take the number off of page one.
Yeah, the last line on page one is AGI, and then page two, you actually repeat that number at the top of page two. And so the way the form is laid out conceptually is you have the income that gets taxed, and then you have some what are called above the line deductions that everybody gets to get. And then you move to page two and you get your itemized deductions. And then even below that will be this deduction. It is a new concept. And one of the, there's a kind of a recursive situation where the amount of the deduction depends on federal taxable income. And you can't get to federal taxable income until you, after you calculate the deduction. So the best way I can think that they'll do it is, on the form, you'll get down to a tentative federal taxable income, and then you'll calculate this deduction, and then you'll get to the actual federal taxable income.
Okay.
Follow up?
So I noticed, I'm going to look at your screen here. So by disconnecting on some of the other charts that you showed us, it came in at, I think, 100. I'm doing this out of memory, so I might be totally wrong, but I think it was 181 million. Now you're up to 254 million by disconnecting. Why are those numbers different?
The 180 million was tax year 18. Once we get to the revenue impact statement, it's a tax collection standpoint. So basically, that 17-19 number is can be thought of as a year and a half. It's collections that come in. It'll be all of 2018, and then 2019 taxpayers will be submitting estimated payments and withholding and so forth. So it's kind of a year and a half.
Payments are added. You're adding the estimated payments in.
Right. So the timing can get a little bit strange when we get down to that piece, but that's kind of the last piece of the revenue estimating. We do the liability, and then we have to map it to collections. So those are the three biennia that Kyle went over. The first one is kind of a year and a half, and then you get to two-year numbers.
Okay.
One more question. I think one of the things that this amendment does, Chris, is it is much more simple than the first few iterations. We tried maybe to be too clever and adding sole proprietors to the state tax break and the tax cut to others, and made the bill much more expensive and much more complex. And so that's why we're back here, to make it just very clean, just disconnect from this federal bill under the very basic premise that there's already a state tax break, and nobody gets seconds until everybody goes through the line, and that's really all it does. We didn't spend any time yet talking about this other part of the bill, which helps high household taxpayers with federal deductions. That hasn't changed. Did you want to give us a 30-second review on that?
The part that hasn't changed? The opportunity grant. Yeah, that is an auction tax credit. And the idea there is, it's partly in response to, it gives taxpayers an opportunity to make contributions to that fund. It's an auction tax credit. It's modeled off of the film and video tax credit, where taxpayers can buy that tax credit and have that fully offset against their Oregon taxes, and then receive a charitable deduction against their federal taxes for those tax credits that they purchase at auction.
Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any idea what that is? It going to be? Do you think they'll be auctioned off at full value, or will it be a discounted amount, 70%, 60%, 80%? Do we have any idea?
The floor is 95%, so they can't be sold less than 90% of face value. We are in a situation where there are questions about the demand for tax credits. Now, under prior federal law, a lot of that demand seemed to derive from taxpayers caught up in the federal AMT. So now we have a new landscape at the federal level. Fewer taxpayers are affected by the AMT, but what has come into play are the limitations on the state and local deductions. So that could actually, so we have forces going both ways. By a reduction in taxpayers affected by the AMT, there could be less demand. But by the impact of the SALT deductions, the demand could be greater for these tax credits.
Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I have several questions, but we're still all over the place. So let me ask you one question first so that I can get some clarity here. The basic intent is the A13 Amendment, correct?
Correct.
So let's resolve that issue first. Mr. Chair, I move the A13 Amendment into 1528, dated 2/16/18, and then I'll speak to the amendment, the motion.
Let me make sure that...
you have the votes.
Senator Boquist moves the A13 Amendment into 1528. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, now I have some questions so I can understand this, so you wouldn't mind indulging me.
Go ahead.
Chris, now that we have the A13 in front of us, we've cleared up all of the previous discussion. Now we're really talking about the A13 in the bill, so we understand it. As it sits right now, my understanding is that we're going to disconnect with, if this passes, we're going to disconnect with the federal PTE, and we're going to disconnect completely, including all sole proprietorships, all LLCs, all LLPs, all subchapter S corporations. Is that correct?
Chair Hass, Vice Chair Boquist, correct.
Okay, so therefore, that we'll assume that it's either one side says it's a tax increase, one side says it's they're not going to get something. Let's just forget that whole perspective right now, because nobody's going to agree that one side's going to say it's a tax increase, one side's going to say it's a benefit prevention. Let's just forget that discussion. Let's go back to the existing law right now in Oregon, and that is the state pass-through. That state pass-through does not apply to sole proprietorships, correct?
Correct. The Oregon preferential rates for pass-through income does not apply to sole proprietors.
So therefore, with the passage of the A13 in this bill, what's going to happen is you're going to have one group of small businesses. That's the small businesses, not including the sole proprietorships, are going to have this benefit. And I was in the room, so was Senator Beyer, so was Governor Kitzhaber, so was Senator Burdick. That benefit was designed to create equity for capitalization for business expansion. It wasn't an employee bill. But that benefit now is solely going to be with those existing individuals, and sole proprietorships will not have that benefit. So we're not double dipping. Sole proprietorships are thrown out, correct?
They're not existing
in the present law.
What a wonderful
right,
surprise.
They're not existing in the present law, and they have the choice, and we heard from some CPAs that a sole proprietor, if they change their structure, they could change their structure to a partnership or an S-corp and then benefit from the Oregon law.
One last question, Mr. Chair, just for clarity.
Sure. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when we say term sole proprietorship, I do need to get this on the record so we understand. A sole proprietorship could be me, an individual, as a sole proprietorship, and I run and do the entire business. However, a sole proprietor could be me, and I could have 10 or 20 employees. So the notion of that sole proprietorship in one individual is really just a business structure. Is that not correct?
Correct. It's a business structure. There, it is not dependent on any number of employees. From anecdotal evidence and talking to folks, generally, sole proprietors are just one person, but they certainly can have employees. Having employees doesn't preclude the business from being a sole proprietor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, Senator Courtney. We could go on and on. We had sole proprietors in one of the earlier amendments. It didn't seem to get traction. So now it's out.
Are you ready, Mr. Chair?
I'm ready.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 1528 as amended by the A13 to the floor. With a due pass, I suppose.
Senator Boquist moves 1528 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and audience, I've been in business since I was 19 years old. I've been part of sole proprietor, partnership, and an S corporation. And in the scheme of things, this may not look like a lot of money, but I'm going to tell you who this really affects. It's not going to affect old gray-haired guys like us. What this is going to affect is new startups, young people who are starting their life and their own business, where $2,000 to the bottom line means a lot. In fact, it means whether they're going to stay in business or not. Most businesses fail, startups, in the first couple years. That's what this is going to hurt, are those people. Young people. People of disadvantage that don't have the access to capital. That's what this is going to do. That's who is getting hurt. It's not hurting the top end, it's hurting the bottom end. And by that, I'm definitely going to be voting no on this because I support startups. In my district, you know how many young people come to me and ask for advice on how to start up a business? And for anybody that's been in business or in accounting or whatever, it's complicated. Trying to comply with all the regulations and the do's and the don'ts. And it's almost weekly that I have people come to me and say, oh, how do I handle this? And how do I handle that? And what should I do here? And I give that advice because I'll tell you what, it's not easy starting up. I used to always say the first 10 years I was in business, I had one foot on a banana peel and the other one in bankruptcy. But through tenacity, I stayed with it. And this bill, that's who it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt the young folks. The entrepreneurs, the next generation.
Further discussion, Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Haas. I want to thank you, Chair Haas, for bringing this bill forward and for recognizing that we had a unique situation with the bill that was passed out of Congress, the Trump tax bill, or whatever we're calling it. And I think it's incredibly responsible for you, and I think it's important that we as a body vote to support this because the people who are benefiting from this, everyone who came and testified and everything that we had presented to us, the evidence, at least to me, was overwhelming that it was benefiting, if we did not do this, I should say, that if we did not pass this and we kept it the way we were going to stay connected, it would benefit very high earners, bottom line, regardless of what they did for a living. And I don't see any reason why we should be, especially since they already received the benefit from the other pass-through provision that was passed in 2013. To receive this in addition just seems over the top, especially when it only benefits very, very high income earners. By not voting yes on this, we will be negatively impacting the general fund, and we have responsibilities to fund our schools and to pay for all the other services that I think all of us, I'd like to think, are important for all Oregonians. So I just wanted to say thank you, and I'm looking forward to voting yes here and on the floor.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Senator Taylor certainly doesn't represent my opinion, so I don't agree with her in any aspect whatsoever. It's not meant as disrespect at all. I don't see the individual who's starting up a company, I don't even see the young lobbyists that are out here as being, you know, some high income earners. You know, we want to talk a lot of BS, and that's what it is about children around here. My children suffered every single day when I was a business owner. And I employed lots of people out there trying to help them. And while we're sitting here talking about, you know, the general fund and, you know, these sole proprietorships, these LLCs, these LLPs, these S corporations and pass-throughs are all higher income. I'm not going to disagree with Senator Bertschinger in the fact that it's going to hurt startups, but I'll tell you who this is going to help. Let's just be very clear. absolutely iron clear who this is going to help. This is going to help big corporations. Because big corporations are going to have a serious advantage with a 40% tax cut, and their goal is to run all these small businesses from NFIB, from all these business organizations out there, out of business and take up their market share. And this bill is going to help those big corporations run them out of business. And so if we want nothing but big corporations, then we can continue with failed tax policy after failed tax policy. And so I'm happy to say no on this, and I'm happy to point out that Senator Courtney is to the far right there, and I appreciate him coming down here because there is a specific reason why I'm not going to provide a courtesy vote to come out here, because I believe this will pass the Senate floor with less than 18 votes. I believe it is a tax increase. And rather than waiting for big business to come to the rescue of small business, I will take whatever action is necessary in a courtroom. And that's why I'm voting no here, to ensure that we stop this lunacy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, one of the hallmarks of this committee has always been that we all agree to disagree on occasion. And this is one of those times. I guess I would hang my hat on the opinion of the very pro-business tax foundation that called this bad policy to connect to this. Even they say we should decouple, and that is all we're doing here. We've decoupled from federal tax law before, and it's turned out to be a wise choice. And really what we're doing here is charting our own course. That's what we do in Oregon. We don't let others do it for us. So I just strongly believe now is not the time, with the needs we have in education and universities and community colleges especially, now is not the time to give a second tax break to a group of individuals who own businesses. So with that, let's have the clerk call the roll.
Senator Bechtier?
No.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist?
No, thank you.
Chair Hass?
Hass votes aye.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senate Bill 1528 passes with a due pass recommendation to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. I will be the carrier. And I'll close that work session.
Now let's move to a happier topic.
And we will take a 1 minute recess and come back for 1520. Work session on Senate Bill 1520A. Public hearing and work session, that is. Just so everyone knows, this is an omnibus bill, mostly with technical changes in education, and I serve on the Education Committee, and our peek into this from a Revenue Committee standpoint has to do with the section that deals with dorms and the formula, because that's part of the purview of the Senate Revenue Committee. It's certainly not my intention to make any changes in any of the other technical aspects. In fact, it's not even my intention to make any change with respect to this section, and I don't believe anybody has any other amendments here. So what I'd like to do is to just give the committee a refresher course on how the formula works, what this part does to the formula, and how it works. We're talking about very small schools who have foreign students enrolled there, and the formula pays the costs for those students as well. So I will turn it over to Dave Beck to give us the rundown on this section of 1520.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Like Sarah has mentioned, this bill comes from Senate Education Committee, and we put a request for referral to us because there are a couple of sections, actually, provisions that relate to state school fund distribution. So one was actually the availability of kindergarten programs. So Section 14 actually clarifies that when a school district offers a full-day kindergarten in a school, the school doesn't have to offer half-day kindergarten program. There was a confusion about that, so it clarifies that there's no need to. And the second, more importantly, it's about preserving resident status of foreign exchange students living in a Oregon school district operated dormitories. So it's extending the sunset on provisions, allowing them to be considered as resident students for another 2 years. So what happens is to support these qualified foreign exchange student as resident students, we have to appropriate, first of all, general purpose grant based on ADNW. And so these exchange students would add to the district's ADNW. And for 18-19 school year, actually, the general purpose grant for ADNW is estimated at 7,800. So $7,800 per ADNW. We're talking about 40 students in a school year. So that is calculated to be about $300,000 a year. So for biennium, it's double that. So it is not a small sum, but for five school districts in a rural area where they run dormitories for these foreign exchange students, that's quite a bit of money for their operational expenses. So you have a full revenue impact at $300,000 a year, $600,000 per biennium, and that's for 18-19 and 19-20 school years. That's all.
Okay, this is now capped. When did that get added in, the number of students, you know?
Okay, the provision started in 2011, as I remember it, and then it's been extended for a couple of years, every 2 years, and it's supposed to sunset on at the end of 2018. It's extended to a couple of years.
I think just to give this some color, when I was chairing the Education Committee, the Department of Education put this on my radar and said it really wasn't the ideal way for schools to operate, and it was going to sunset. And it wasn't on anybody's radar until the end of, I think, 2011. Senator Farioli grabbed me and said, "We can't do this to these schools." And so we did sort of a last day bill to give it another 2 years with the promise that we would figure out a better way to do this. And the reason this is a stretch is because of the cost of running a school with 20 kids. And we had, I think the following session, I remember a superintendent from one of those school districts come over and say, "Look, I don't know that this is the most ethical way to do it, but it's the only way we can keep our doors open, is to get ADMW for these foreign students and kind of subsidize our operation." And I think that statement kind of embodies the dilemma here, to help small schools, extremely small schools. And so in the ensuing 4 years or 6 years, there's been no better ideas. There are some models out there in other states that where foreign students pay tuition to go, and I'm not sure that would work here, but in the meantime, this bill says until somebody comes up with a better way to do it, we're going to move the sunset out another 2 years.
Mr. Chair, I just want to reframe. I fully agree with this, but I think I want to reframe for the record and then get LRO to nod their head. Is that while we're sort of focusing on the foreign exchange students, the issue we're sort of addressing is exactly like you said, is we have five school districts that are rural, that they are so rural. Buckeye is an example, which I believe was in Senator Farioli's district, I believe, in which the issue is that they're such a distance to travel that they bus them in, for a better word, on Monday, early Monday morning. They spend in the dormitory till Thursday night, and then they bus them home, and generally in most cities, and they do full day school, longer school than everybody else, and they bus them home. And then the issue of the foreign exchange student is kind of put in is if a foreign exchange student signs up and, you know, is able to get an exchange position in Seneca, right, which is in the Ukiah school district, so everybody has no clue what I'm talking about, in Seneca, that foreign exchange student then would be able to go to school with the other people in the dormitories that are there. So it's not just a dormitory for foreign exchange students. It's all the kids in that school district are spending the night there. Makes and sense. So it then allows the cultural opportunity for the rural area. And of course, you're absolutely correct, Mr. Chair, on this one, in which there is no better solution at the moment. If somebody has a better solution, you know. But I just wanted to make sure we're on the record that it's, you know, it's really the five school districts. Those kids are already staying in the dormitories for the most part. And then the foreign exchange students that come in as exchange students to those families then have the ability to be in the school program with those other kids that are there. Have I got that right here? Okay, I do. Okay, yeah, thank you.
That's a good summary.
Question, Senator Burchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, on the 90-day grace period, so a school district can hire a teacher before the teacher's licensed and have 90 days that teacher can work for them while they're going through the licensing period, and I don't really have a problem with that. My dad might. But anyway, what I don't like about it, which I'm concerned about, is also that grace period is extended to criminal and background checks. So they're having a licensed teacher, or they're having an unlicensed teacher working for the school district without a criminal background check.
Great. Is that clarified? Is that accurate? I'm sorry, Chair Haas, may I ask a question?
Yeah, is that accurate? Is that, is that not accurate?
Dave?
I have to say I'm not equipped, not versed in answering that question. We can take a look at it. All these policies actually were fully vetted at the Senate Education Committee, and the sole purpose of bringing this bill to us was to take a look at a couple of issues, couple of provisions. So I can check with Senate Education Administrator and get back to you.
Senator Taylor.
Chair Haas, I completely agree with Senator Birchiker. I think that's definitely something that probably is the case, but I would think, but maybe is LC watching? Maybe someone from LC could run over or.
What section are you looking at?
Looking on page two, 5 through 8, and so I don't have ORS 181A, 195 to look at, so that's why I'm asking the question.
Maybe Hannah Lai is listening in.
Where are you at? Page 2, where?
Page 2, line 5 through 8, or maybe even 5 through 12, somewhere in there.
So that looks like existing law. Am I missing something here? 5 through 8 look like existing law, other than they added in, instead of commission, it says teacher standards and practice. Looks like a technical fix or something.
Yeah.
But I have no idea.
And I don't either, so that's, I just want clarification. And
during their practicum, they probably already have
their
commission.
Okay, I'll stand by and wait for a note from, see whether the LC drafter can clarify that for you.
Why don't we change teach to be employed? You never know about these lawyers. I'm just curious, what's the difference between teaching and being employed, and why are we changing it? It's the flavor of the week. Some lawyer decided that, okay, we don't like that, but we like this lawyer this year, and then
it's all the ways that it could possibly be used.
LC is on their way down.
Thank you.
Sure.
standing by.
Yes. I saw that. We're not going to go rogue till at least tomorrow, so you're fine today. I just out of courtesy for you. Yeah, right. Well, this is a rarity, Mr. Chair. There's stone silence in the Revenue Committee. That's generally not a problem.
Oh. We could go back to talking about that 1528.
You know. Don't you remember, Mr. Chair, we both did attend that civility training a couple of years ago, so let's not go back to 528. That doesn't look like LC. Koba, you're not LC. Quit screwing with the door.
My staff just sent me the screenshot. I'm
surprised they didn't catch that in the Education Committee.
I know, man. I'm not.
Mark.
No, but I know about small schools.
No, I don't have no problem with the bill. It's just a technical thing that I want to make sure.
No, I was going to say, my wife is from Pilot Rock in the spring.
Really?
So
rural Oregon.
Anywhere you go, you got to go 75 miles to get a quart of milk.
Yep.
Virtual public charter schools are in here, too. Somebody's coming with a purpose. There we go. Somebody's finally coming with a purpose.
Oh my.
Hannah. Thank you for coming down. Hope we didn't interrupt what you were working on.
Oh, this is much better. Thank you, sir.
Did you hear that? You're on television for the rest of your life now.
This is much better. I mean, just a little research question, but yes, sir. What can I do for you?
We had a question on section one about the 90-day calendar date and whether that means someone without a background check can be employed versus being a teacher. And maybe, Senator Burcher, you want to phrase your question better?
Yes. The 90-day provision on page two, line five, it starts. What I'm concerned about is that they are able to hire somebody before they have their license. They're going through the licensing process. But can they also hire them without going through a background check? They got that 90 days to get that background check done, too? Am I reading that correctly?
Okay. So, Hannah Lai, from Legislative Council. The 90-day grace period that we have with the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission here would require that the person pass any background checks first. So if there were any criminal issues, that would already be checked. So we're talking about somebody who has already applied for a license. It's in the hopper. They've been approved for the background check, so we know they don't have this criminal past. And they're just here. They have this 90-day grace period until the license has been officially approved.
Follow up, sir.
So I want to make it perfectly clear for the record, the 90-day grace period is only for the licensing process and it is not for the background check.
That would be correct. The background check, if I could even see it really fast, I know it is required first. Yes, the lines 6 and 7. So they would already require to have that. That's correct, sir.
That satisfies me. I appreciate it. I wanted to make sure.
Senator, you should be in the Education Committee.
I was.
He should replace me on student success. I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Since we have Hannah here?
Yes, that's right. Since we do.
Senator Boquist.
Other than the fact that, you know, it's, you know, the word of the month is up and we're changing language, could you tell me in lines 2 and 3, page 2, what's the purpose of changing, because there must be a policy purpose here, because the two are not synonymous. What's the purpose of changing teach to be employed? Because one is teach, That is a specific action, teacher, teaching. The other is be employed, which could be somebody else.
That is correct, Senator Boquist. When we looked at the statute later, we realized that right now it could be interpreted to be only teachers.
Right.
And the issue would be, what about administrators or school nurse? So we wanted the point of this was to broaden it so that anybody that's required to have a license under TSPC could be employed. So it would not just be the teacher, it would be the administrator, the school nurse, anybody else licensed by TSPC.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow
up. This is a Rules Committee question, so it's a trick question, right?
Oh,
but
great.
This did came up, and it's behind us. But I mean, so my assumption then is that, let's just say, if you hire a teacher or administrator or whomever you just mentioned, right, that they, the districts, the 200 or 198 or 200 districts, hopefully are smart enough to say that you're being employed subject to passage of or acceptance of getting your license. Is that correct? Is there, in a rule, just example to give you what I'm looking at. Rules Committee, we had somebody that we were hiring. We wanted that person to start immediately. They weren't a member of the Oregon State Bar Association. They had filed their paperwork. Lawyers do not move quickly, no disrespect, right? And so, therefore, though we approved that individual in the state Senate as to be hired, there was an employment agreement said, you know, this is subject to you becoming a member of the Oregon Bar, sort of like this, within the next 90 days. And so I'm assuming the clawback or the, as we use in revenue here, or the fail-safe for this is the employment contract probably would say, if you're administrator, you have to have your administrator license in so many days, or else you get not fired or unterminated or whatever. Am I somewhere on the right track here?
I think that would be correct. Again, this was to expand it so that you would have more people fall under this 90-day grace period.
Okay.
And there probably would be appropriate clauses in the employment contracts.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for legislative council?
Come on, we have about 33 pages here.
You want to just go through page by page?
I've already done that for the Senate Ed.
Well, these guys are showing some interesting interest.
They have good questions.
Yeah, they do, don't they?
Are you ready, Mr. Chair, so she can leave?
We're in work session.
We're in work session.
Mr.
Chair,
like
I move Senate Bill 1520 A and Gross to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 1528A and Gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Are there objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 1528A moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Roblin will be the carrier. And on that note, the Senate Committee on Finance and Education will adjourn.